for the call of God as it comes to us in Scripture, but I want to set it up a little bit for you. The story that we'll be focusing on for the month of November within our Scripture readings is the story that comes from Genesis, the story of Jacob. And if you look at the book of Genesis, it's like a family album, and there's generations. And you get to delve into one generation, and then there's a shift, and you're into the next generation. The biblical scholars who treat it as literature call these story cycles. We're focused on the story cycle of Jacob, who was the son of Isaac. And so we went Abraham, Isaac, we're into the Jacob cycle. And the reason I chose this cycle is because it's a great study in reconciliation. And because it's so doggone real. We think of this Bible as a holy book, right? If that's the way you think about it, read the story of Jacob, because it's a mess. And God is involved. So, we're going to read a moment in Jacob's life when he comes face to face with God. But there's a whole backstory to that. It starts when he's born. Actually, before he's born. Because the Bible says that God came to his father and said, your wife will become pregnant, and it'll be twins in the womb, and they won't even be getting along in the womb. They will be battling it out in the womb. And it actually says, two nations will be born of you, and those nations also won't get along. So it's kind of set up right from the very beginning. This story is about not getting along and how to try to get along. And right at the birth, it's important to know in that culture who comes first, right? Because whoever's born first has the birthright and the blessing that carries the family name. And when Jacob and Esau are born, Esau was born first. But Jacob is hanging on to his heel as he comes out, right? The whole thing is set up right from the very beginning. Later on, when Isaac gets old and it's time to pass on things, well, actually, just before that, Jacob and Esau are very different people. Esau's out hunting. Jacob is at home, and it's never quite clear what he's doing. But he is at home. And Esau comes home and is really, really starving, hungry. And Jacob's got the food. And he basically weasels the birthright out of Esau because he's hungry. He takes advantage of him and says, well, I'll give you food if you give me the birthright. Later on, Isaac is getting old. It's time to pass on the blessing. And he's intending to do that. And Jacob's mother, Rebekah, and he conspire, basically, to trick Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing through, cooking up some food that smells like the kind of stuff Esau would bring, and Jacob puts on a coat of skin on his arms so that his arms are hairy and basically tricks his dad into giving him the blessing. Leaves, and then Esau comes back and finds out the trick's on again. And Esau loses it. He's angry. He wants to kill his brother. At this point, Jacob takes off. He's made an absolute hash of it. And he's on his way trying to kind of flee for his life. Goes off to be with Laban, a relative. And builds a life there for himself. But God comes to him and says, and that starts to fall apart at a certain point, so God comes to him and says, you need to go back. It's funny the way God works. You never really leave. You gotta always kind of go back. You can't leave things undone very easily with God. It always comes back to you. So Jacob is on his way back to his family, and he knows that he's going to encounter Esau, and he is scared, because the last moment he saw Esau, did I say that? by the seashore? Sorry. the last time he encountered his brother wanted to kill him. And as far as he knows, his brother has spent the last 20 years fomenting anger against him. As far as he knows, because that's the last he heard. So he's heading back, and Esau, and he has, you know, developed a good life. He's got some flocks and some family and some, you know, he's got a whole life, and he's brought them all with him. And his people are coming this way, and Esau hears that he's coming and comes out to meet him. Comes out to meet his brother. What is this going to look like? Well, if you're Jacob, it does not look good. But you don't know what Esau's thinking. And so Jacob sends out kind of emissaries, folks ahead of him, to try and kind of gifts to appease his brother, right? Ahead of him. And if Esau's about to slaughter, he's at least not going to slaughter him, Jacob, first. Are you liking this guy? So he sends out all these gifts and emissaries as they get closer and closer and closer and closer. And then the night before they're actually going to meet, he sends his immediate family across the river because he doesn't want them to get hurt. You got to hand it to him there. And then he spends the night by himself preparing to meet his brother who he thinks wants to kill him. And in that sleep, it says he wrestles. No doubt, because he's about to face everything he's ever done. He wrestles because he's about to enter into either slaughter or potential reconciliation. And that's where we come to the part of the story we're in right now, where he has an encounter. In the night. Not sure whether it was a sleepless night, but I'm thinking it was a disturbed night.
Good morning. I'm reading from Genesis chapter 18, verses 24 to 31. What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Well, that's what you told me, 18:24-31.
18, did I really? I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong scripture, it's 32.
That's what he gave me.
I'm sorry, that's totally my fault. It's actually chapter 32, same verses, 24-31. Do you want to do this or do you want me to do this?
Sure. It doesn't matter to me.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Sorry, my car died this morning, too. The real challenge to get here. The battery was...
32. Oh, dear. There we are. 22.
You said 24.
24. Okay, start there. Jacob was left alone and goes right down.
Okay. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And so he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there be blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God's face to face, and yet my life is preserved." The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. So be the word of God.
Jacob is a striver. He's somebody who struggles with, what is it? God and humans. And I believe that there's something of a Jacob in all of us, or at least we encounter Jacobs, and we need to find a place of reconciliation, and it really starts with where we are with God. Today we have a real opportunity, because as you likely know, traveling across the country now are and for the next while is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada dealing with the history of Indian residential schools. And the United Church of Canada was part of that. So when we think about spending some time exploring reconciliation, for us, certainly in the United Church, we do well to spend a moment at least focusing on our participation in Indian residential schools and exploring the ways that lead to reconciliation and peace. Back in May, I was talking to Alvin Dixon, who is an elder not only in his own community, but also in our community that we share, the United Church of Canada. And I mentioned that I was thinking about a season of reconciliation and whether he'd be willing to come and talk to us as a United Church person and as an Aboriginal person involved in Truth and Reconciliation. And he said, sure. This was the date we chose. So welcome especially to you today, Alvin. Thank you for being with us, and I invite you to come forward and speak.
Good morning. This has been an interesting morning so far. Will was relating the story of Jacob, I started thinking my mother's grandfather was a guy by the name of Jacob, and he had a brother by the name of Isaac. And that doesn't say much about my family. It says more about the encounter with missionaries, because Jacob's Herzog name was Adeo, and Isaac's name was Guganin. But our early contact with missionaries changed all that. And I don't know where my name came from. Alvin is not a very, biblical name, I think. But most of our people ended up with Christian names. And it leads us to question, I guess, a lot of the things about our relationship. And that relationship between us and you is very broken. And it has a lot to do with how we as a United Church, how we as citizens of Canada don't really relate to each other in a meaningful way. I know that my personal experience is quite different than most of my brothers and sisters, most of my peers who attended those Indian residential schools. My relationship with the United Church has been lifelong. My father was a church organist. He was a choir master. And of his eight children, I was the only one that he took to church with him. I guess I was probably the worst of the eight, so. Anyway. One of my favorite stories about my experiences in the United Church on a Sunday evening in Bella Bella, we held our services in the evening, was my dad would sit facing the wall with his back to the congregation, because that's how the organ sat. But somehow he knew, I guess, when I was misbehaving, because on our way home from the church, he would be scolding me about things that I was doing in the church. And I wonder, how could he possibly know what I did? Because he never once turned around to look at me or the congregation. And after a while, I thought, well, I'm going to watch and see what he does when he goes up there. After he sits me, he used to sit me right in the front row, like about there. And I saw him reach into his pocket and pull out a little mirror. So, anyway, I value my life, short life with my dad. He died when I was 14. I left the family at age 5 to live with a grandmother, my mother's mother, for 5 years. And I thought after she passed away when I turned 10, I would go back to my family, which I did for very, I would think only a few weeks, because I was sent to Alberni Indian Residential School at age 10. And Alberni is on Vancouver Island in Barkley Sound. Bella Bella is halfway between here and Prince Rupert. So it took us 4 days on a Union steamship to travel down from Bella Bella to Vancouver, and then another ferry to Nanaimo. I think it was Harbor to Harbor CP ferries, and then a train from Nanaimo to Port Alberni. And I could hardly, well, I didn't speak English, but I, there were already some children from Bella Bella in residential school when I arrived, because I didn't go there until about mid-September. And the first words out of my mouth were Heiltsuk words. And I wasn't there for two and a half hours before I got my first strapping for speaking the only language I really knew. And that Alberni Indian Residential School was run by the United Church of Canada in concert with the government of Canada. Now I'm gonna, before I talk some more about how we as a United Church were involved in running residential schools, I'm just gonna read a few words of apology. Sorry words, supposedly. And often that when I think of apologies, I think about the experience of the Aborigines and wherever colonization took place. Somehow, sorry is a very important word that needs to be visited frequently. And Australia actually has a sorry day. And in on June 11th, 2008, your Prime Minister, our Prime Minister, made an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. And I'm going to read some of those words, because a lot of people basically deny that the church and the government really didn't do anything but try to educate us, little children. When those little children were leaving, many of them were my age when I went to residential school, and I was thinking, if those little children were going off somewhere, never to return for at least a year, what would you people as parents be thinking? You know, I often think, and then this room is without children, and our villages were just like this room, full of adults but no children. How much laughter, how much humor would be present in those communities without those children? So I'll just read a few words what the Prime Minister said on June 11th, 2008. And he says, to the approximately 80,000 living former students and all family members and communities, the government of Canada now recognizes that it was wrong to forcibly remove children from their homes. And we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that it was wrong to separate children from rich and vibrant cultures and traditions, that it created a void in many lives and communities. And we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that in separating children from their families, we undermine the ability of many to adequately parent their own children, and sow the seeds for generations to follow, and we apologize for having done this. We now recognize that far too often these institutions gave rise to abuse or neglect and were inadequately controlled, and we apologize for failing to protect you. Not only did you suffer these abuses as children, but as you became parents, you were powerless to protect your own children from suffering the same experience, and for this we are sorry. Now, when we as First Nations people heard these words, many celebrated hearing those words. Many became angry. And those of us who celebrated because this provided us hope. It provided us hope that things would begin to change in our relationship. If people throughout the country take ownership of these words and think about their relationship with not just First Nations people, but with each other, with other neighbors, with other new Canadians, how much better a life we would all be living, you know, if we acknowledge each other with respect and trust. We, as a United Church, 1986, offered the first apology. And I was in Sudbury at the 31st General Council as a member of BC Conference staff when we as the United Church offered the first apology to First Nations people. It was basically in response to a lady from Cape Mudge on Quadra Island across from Campbell River who attended a General Council executive meeting of the United Church. And they were talking about the condition, the relationship, and the neglect that we as a United Church were experiencing in our little United Church villages. There are 15 of them on the coast. Today, not one of those villages has an ordained minister, but they're still members of the United Church. When the United Church, or the missionaries before the United Church, came to our villages, they said to our elders, build us a church and we will provide you a minister. So we built those churches. Now we have no ministers. But for years, you know, we had ministers, and as things happen over time, the type of people that came to us don't seem to exist anymore. So that's one aspect of our relationship that is severely broken. I served this United Church in several capacities. I am a member of BC Conference General Executive, and I represent you at General Council as lay representative. And for years, I've been chairing the Indigenous Justice and Residential School Steering Committee for this United Church. I serve Vancouver School of Theology as a member of the Aboriginal Council, which is a national body of the United Church. I also serve the Vancouver School of Theology as a member of the Native Ministries Consortium, which is a theological institution that, when I was on staff in 1982 to 1992, we convinced Vancouver School of Theology to incorporate the teachings and traditions of our native spiritual practices in the teachings of the school, and also incorporated a degree program in Native Ministries. Now, it took some doing to do that. I remember Gordon Howe was our executive secretary, and when we started talking about getting the Vancouver School of Theology to incorporate teaching Native spiritual practices, he says, you need to be on the Senate of Vancouver School of Theology to help promote this with the government, the governance, you know, and the Senate of the Vancouver School of Theology. He says, I'm going to talk to a couple of our representatives on that Senate. So he did, and asked them if either of them would resign so that I could replace them. Both replied with the same statement, that would be tokenism. So Gordon and I sat and talked about that for a while and said, well, it would be tokenism if I didn't know what I was doing and was only there just because, yeah. So he resigned. Gordon gave up his seat on the Senate so that I could replace him. And those are the kinds of acts of reconciliation I think that, you know, we need to work at. I think on both sides, I mean, I often find myself in a very racist mood when I think about my experiences and my relationships with people. And I'm sure you people do too. You know, when you see us on the street and wonder why we are the way we are. I run into lots of people all the time asking me. I remember the very first time I visited I think it was West Vancouver United Church women. I was asked to speak to them. This was probably in the mid-80s. And a little old lady came to me and said, why don't you just be like us? You know? So, anyway, I didn't spend too much time trying to answer her. I just said, we're not like you, so, you know, I'm never going to be like you. I don't look like you. I probably don't feel like you, and all of that. So, anyway, I'm going to spend a little bit of time now talking about us as United Church. In 1992, the United Church set out to raise funds for a healing fund. Now, Will mentioned the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. When we were negotiating that as part of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement, we argued that it should be the Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation Commission. Every one of us First Nations people negotiating in behalf of us as Indian Residential School survivors said it's important to retain the term healing as part of the title of that commission. Canada, in its wisdom, chose to deny that and just now call it the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And along with our negotiations with Canada, we said we need to make sure that the Aboriginal Healing Foundation is funded so that it would provide us with healing experiences for a long time, because it took years and years and years to make us what we are today. And it'll take years and years and years to change that, to heal that. But the Healing Foundation funding runs has run out. They've expended all of their program funds and are in the process of winding down. And Canada is saying that our Health Canada people can do the work that the Healing Foundation used to do. I have a friend sitting here who works with our people on the Central Coast, and she is very much aware and very deeply involved in healing and treating many of my brothers and sisters, not just those of us who went to residential schools, but those who felt the impact of those residential schools through our parents, our brothers and sisters, even though they might not have attended those schools. Now, we as the United Church in 1992 decided to raise funds for a healing fund. And we agreed that the fund would be administered by Aboriginal people, but would be raised by non-Aboriginal people. And a fundraising task group was established, and it was based in Vancouver, and it was chaired by former moderator Bob Smith, the very Reverend Bob Smith. Now, the fundraising strategy for the fund proved to be a foretaste of the resistance of many in the church held to the concept of taking responsibility for the United Church participation in the misguided social policy manifest in the running of residential schools. Those are words expressed by the Reverend Brian Thorpe, who was part of that task group. Gatherings to promote the fund were often sparsely attended. Contributions were very slow in coming. Reflecting on his experience with the fundraising efforts for the Healing Fund, Bob Smith says, "The whole of Canadian society doesn't take this seriously at all. When Hurricane Mitch devastated Central America in 1988, over $1 million was raised by churches in short order with no solicitation whatsoever. During this period, it took 6 years to raise that much for our healing fund." Bob Smith goes on to say, "I have never had a more challenging experience. I personally wrote to 300 people myself and got maybe 1 in 10 responses," Bob says. Now, I mentioned the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. And it was created in March of 1998 and given 10 years to disperse $350 million beginning in March of 1999 and ending in March 2009. Mike DeGaney of the Aboriginal Healing Foundation says, "An apology is the gateway to forgiveness, and forgiveness is the gateway to healing, and healing is the gateway to reconciliation. While many survivors find it is difficult to forgive, often not knowing who to forgive, several have moved far along their healing journeys. These former students of Indian Residential School have chosen to move from pathologizing their experience and to do serious work on healing and reconciliation. They do this mostly for their own peace of mind, peace for their loved ones and their communities. Our organization, the Indian Residential School Survivors Society, is well on its way to changing its approach to treatment of former students by promoting the attitude of moving to positive actions rather than wallowing in self-pity, blame, and inflicting harm on themselves by using drug and alcohol as a means of escape." Bob Watts spoke at UBC the other day, and Bob Watts is a former chief of staff of the Assembly of First Nations and also the first executive director of the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And he says, Reconciliation is developing unity from diversity. Now, there's nothing more diverse than us as a United Church. Nothing more diverse as us as a city, as a nation. If we buy into the concept of developing unity from diversity, we can only succeed in making our world a better place for our children, our grandchildren. What better legacy do we want to leave them? Instead of complaining that our children are becoming minorities in schools where Chinese and Indo-Canadians are often outnumbering our children, we should be celebrating the experience, the exposures offered by the new cultures. We also have a great opportunity to share our culture, our traditions with these new Canadians. Our future as a culture, as a society, as a nation, rests with our children. We should be doing everything we can to provide them with tools, with a legacy that does not create impediments to a world of peace, caring, and right relations. Now, Vancouver will host on September 18 to 21 in 2013 the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I should tell you that we as the United Church played a major role in making sure that the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a part of the settlement agreement. At a general council in 2003 in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, George Erasmus, who chaired the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Affairs, came to speak to us as the United Church and challenged us to work with Canada to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and challenged us that if Canada didn't agree that we as the United Church engaged the other three churches that ran Indian residential schools to do it ourselves. And we as the United Church started hosting gatherings of those other churches and other Aboriginal groups and Indian residential school survivor groups. We hosted them in our offices in Toronto to talk about making sure that Truth and Reconciliation was part of the settlement agreement. So we have a lot to be proud of. We have a lot to be proud of in having had the courage to do what many in our church didn't want us to do. So UBC and other institutes of higher learning are fast getting on board in terms of making sure that, you know, I once challenged the University of BC, saying, you people crank out a lot of teachers. What are you doing to crank out the material they teach? Because that material doesn't include our history, our real history, the history of colonization, the history of Indian residential schools. And somebody in that school heard, because they're now working very hard at getting all of the higher institutions of learning to talk about how they might do all of that. And they plan to be present en masse at that National Truth and Reconciliation Commission in September 2013. And our church also monthly hosts a gathering of ecumenical ambassadors at our BC conference's offices. We're now meeting once every month to talk about how we as churches might engage the Truth and Reconciliation process. And it's not just those four churches that ran schools. There are many others, like, Pentecostals, Quakers, Lutherans, Baptists, who join us in those gatherings. and are very serious about how they will engage the process and are very serious about how they will help staff and volunteer for that commission. One of the events we plan is a reconciliation march of at least 50,000 people to go into BC Place and celebrate as a nation reconciliation. The city of Vancouver declared a reconciliation week not a month ago. And they're thinking and working at establishing a reconciliation year. We're telling them to declare themselves as the reconciliation city. And I think they're going to be working very hard at doing that. So all of the apologies that we've heard of should be gateways to healing and reconciliation. And what will it take for this to become a reality? It will take many acts of reconciliation by each and every one of us, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, new Canadian, old Canadian. And this will only happen if we consciously, intentionally take the time to talk with each other, hear each other, listen to each other, respect and trust each other as equals. Let's get on with it. Thank you.
I'm going to chase down Alvin later for the text of what he just said. I don't know how much of it is actually on the page and how much of it is just right off the top, but in case you're wanting to get reference to that. So the task is before us, and the place that we go for nourishment, for that great work of reconciliation, is the table of grace. We're going to skip straight to the communion part of our service.